Hello, listeners, and welcome to Sportspiel, the podcast with more bite than the lion that had a nibble on the hand of rugby player Scott Baldwin. Joining me, Alistair Hooper, as ever to discuss all things sport, is Mr. Will Moulton.
Good afternoon, my friend. Why would you think a lion could be petted like a cat? I don't get it.
It's one of my favourite stories this week because of the sheer absence of common sense.
I just loved it when Steve Tandy was giving his interview how straight-faced he was.
The quotes on that interview are simply wonderful. Also, if anyone hasn't seen the video on social media yet, I urge you to.
It's quite funny.
It is quite something. If you are new to the podcast, in the first section, myself and Will are going to discuss some of the biggest sports talking points in the news at the moment. On this episode, we're going to discuss the Ashes squad, which was announced this week, as well as the fallout regarding Ben Stokes, who was arrested following a punch-up outside a nightclub. After that, we're then going to discuss the latest and ongoing crises at British bobsleigh with the Winter Olympics fast approaching. The second period of the podcast is our feature interview segment, where myself or Will hold a one-on-one feature interview with a sporting star. On this episode, Will spoke to Scotland's most decorated female athlete in Commonwealth history, Jen McIntosh. The Olympian rifle shooter talks to us about competing against her sister and also living up to her mother's medal-winning standards. All that and more on Sportspiel. Right, let's get this show on the road. And the first topic of discussion is the Ashes squad, which was announced this week for the upcoming Winter Ashes series in Australia, which starts in November and goes all the way through until January. I'm going to rattle through the 16-man squad very quickly. Joe Root is the captain, Moeen Ali, James Anderson, Johnny Bairstow, Jake Ball, Gary Balance, Stuart Broad, Alistair Cook, Mason Crane, Ben Folkes, Dawid Milan, Craig Overton, Ben Stokes, Mark Stoneman, James Vince, and finally Chris Wokes. First off, since you tweeted out your own Ashes squad and who you'd pick, how does it differ to your own, and what do you make of the team that England are sending over?
So the main difference in the terms of a starting 11 for me is a lack of Alex Hales. So I picked him as a left field selection to come in middle order. It's where he seems to be doing well for Nottinghamshire over the last couple of years. And I thought he could have got a shout and with Tom Wesley not being in the squad, but not to be. But in terms of the overall squad, it's been slated. People have been coming out and saying it's the weakest batting lineup we've ever sent to Australia, but I think if you look at it, you know, it only takes for a couple of these batsmen who are seemingly under pressure to find a little bit of form, and all of a sudden we look like a pretty strong side again. We beat South Africa 3-1 not that long ago with a very similar batting lineup, so the criticism I think has been unfair. Australia themselves are in a bit of a transitional period at the moment. They're a bit more settled than England are, but they've got a couple of batsmen, you know, who one or two low scores are going to be under pressure. So I think it's going to be a tight series, actually. I think both teams are in a similar sort of situation in terms of selection. So I think people are writing England off far too early.
That's definitely a more positive outlook than I've heard from a certain few people on this England team. I think one being the mighty Piers Morgan, who seems
but he doesn't
convinced.
Know anything.
He seems pretty convinced that the Australians will eat them up.
I mean, you're getting the likes of Kevin Peterson coming out and saying we shouldn't bother going on the plane, Piers Morgan, you know, slating the squad, but you've also got Michael Vaughan, who, you know, is a 2005 Ashes winning captain, a very, very much respected pundit, coming out and saying we haven't got a chance, and Jonathan Agnew as well. But I know I'm young and I know, you know, I haven't had the interaction, I haven't been around, but looking at it from the outside, these are two teams in similar situations. Australia's bowling attack for Australian conditions is a bit stronger, but I can't see it being a whitewash. I may have to eat those words, but I think we should be positive. If Mark Stoneman and Dawid Milan both showed some fighting spirit at the end of the summer, they've both got pretty decent techniques. It's just the mental side that's a bit, you know, iffy. And you've got James Vince, again, fantastic technique, but it's just his mental side. So if they can sort that out and two of the three of them score runs regularly alongside Cook, Bairstow, Root, Stokes, then this is a great batting side.
That's always a positive look, and I like positive looks. Now, this is where I have some fun, because I'm going to play a little game which I haven't told you about. So here's what I did. I went to the original tweet on the England Cricket official Twitter, where they announced the initial Ashes squad, and I read through some of the responses to that tweet. I picked some out, And I'm going to read them out to you, and you have to say why they're either rubbish or true.
I can do that.
Right, here we go. Tweet one. This comes from @Woodford_Simon. So if you're listening by any miracle, here's your first tweet. OMG balance. Why? That's 10 whys, by the way.
I can understand that argument, because balance over the last couple of years on the international scene has looked like a bit of a rabbit in the headlights. But there's a reason for that, and he's coming in at 3 playing for England, where at Yorkshire he scores a ton of runs, and he's coming in at 5 lower down the order when the bowling's the bowlers are a bit more tired normally. The ball has got a bit less pace on it. He does have a technical deficiency in terms of if he gets caught on the back foot, he'll then stay on the back foot. You pitch it up and he'll get bowled or LBW. So England have been batting him in the wrong position, and therefore now he looks like a bit of a rubbish batsman, which he's not. He scores runs consistently, but I can see why people aren't happy with his selection. But I think, used correctly, he could be a good batsman.
Have that, Woodford_Simon. Tweet 2 comes from @Gavin1Ruff. Here's the tweet. A couple of thoughts. Gary Balance, really? Number 2, do the selectors know who Jack Leach is?
Yeah, very, very good point about Jack Leach. Somerset left-arm spinner, takes wickets for fun in the county championship. I think he took a 5 in the last game of the season to try and keep Somerset up, which he did, but they beat Middlesex. There was an issue surrounding his bowling action last year. He was picked for a Lions tour, went for a lot of runs and was sent home early to work on his action. Came back with his modified action, took a load of wickets in County Championship cricket this year and wasn't even considered for selection. I think he can consider himself the most unlucky man in English cricket at the moment. Should definitely be on the plane.
Tweet 3 from @Muzza2017. Mason Crane? He'll get eaten alive in Australia.
Yeah, he's an untried talent. He's very young. He didn't play a lot of Red Bull cricket this year, which was worrying. He spent a lot of time with England but not playing, which I think is a bit of a waste. I think you should have bunged him in. If he wasn't going to get selected in the Test squad, bung him back into county cricket. I think he took 16 wickets, an average of 43, which isn't great. But last year, he went over to Australia, played grade cricket, did really, really well, ended up playing 3 games for New South Wales in first-class cricket and did really, really well. Australian conditions can suit leg spinners. It's just a case of he could get eaten alive just because of not his lack of talent, but because he hasn't played enough Red Bull cricket this year because England haven't managed him correctly.
Tweet number 4, the penultimate tweet, from @Burger85Hughes. Concerned about the lack of pace, there doesn't seem a lot of variation in the bowling.
No, that's completely true. Anderson, Broad, both sort of mid to low 80s, both rely on their swing. And as we said earlier, the ball doesn't swing, the Kookaburra doesn't swing. But Anderson and Broad have both taken wickets before. You've got Wokes as well, who's a little bit down on pace at the moment. There's not a bowler that you would have who could sort of steam in, bowl 90 mile an hour, 5-over spells, really, you know, work on the batsman's rib cages like a Mitchell Starc or a Mitchell Johnson. It's where I would have potentially picked Liam Plunkett in the squad, but they didn't. They just decided not to. And yeah, no, I agree with that. The bowling attack is a little bit predictable.
And the final tweet from @CarlBO9, we are doomed.
No, never say never. I can understand the negativity, but as I said earlier, Australia aren't in the best positions themselves. It takes one of their fast bowlers to break down, as they seem to do every 5 minutes, and all of a sudden, you know, England's batting lineup looks fairly ordinary. Not ordinary, fairly good again. So we're not doomed.
Positive outlook. I like it. I should do that game more. That means I don't have to. Means I don't have to do any work. Anywho, big cricket talking point of the week, however, which kind of overshadowed the announcement of the Ashes squad, is Ben Stokes, who was arrested following a punch-up in Bristol. Piers Morgan said that he was defending 2 men from homophobic abuse. That remains to be seen if that's true or not. And, of course, Alex Hales was also with him. The video of said punch-up was published on The Sun. And to say it doesn't look good is a little bit of an understatement, considering. And another video also emerged via the Express newspaper that showed Ben Stokes imitating Katie Price's disabled son. A lot of people are asking, A, should Ben Stokes be stripped of the vice captaincy? And B, should he even be going on the Ashes squad?
Answer to A is probably. It was a little bit worrying when he was announced as vice captain, given his previous disciplinary issues. Should he be going to the Ashes? Initially, I would have said no, but if he was, if the rumours are true, and of course the video footage of the punch-up hasn't actually been confirmed as Ben Stokes, we have to say allegedly, but if it's confirmed that it was him and that he was defending two guys from homophobic abuse and attack, then maybe I think it all depends on the police case and when it opens. I think if sort of the trial and the inquest and stuff are still going on, and when they're due to be out there, I think they can't have that distraction hanging over him, and also can't be hanging over the squad because that's unfair on them. So it all depends on that announcement of when that's going to take place.
It's worth saying that Ben Stokes has been indefinitely suspended by the ECB on full pay, but I can't really see how he's going to end up on that Ashes plane, because realistically, how long is a police investigation going to last, considering they leave relatively soon? And like you said, you don't want that hanging over the squad.
I think I'm sure the ECB will try and pull some strings to get a date announced as soon as possible, so they can either, you know, prepare for life with Ben Stokes or life without Ben Stokes. So let's hope that an announcement is made in the next couple of weeks, say, about sort of dates and stuff like that. Just to take this away, because English cricket, it's a bit of a laughing stock at the moment with this hanging over. It's like, well, men's cricket, the women's cricket's fine. The women are great. Women are fantastic. But on the men's side, it's not great. And the ECB have handled it fairly well, but what they shouldn't have done was admitted that they hadn't seen the footage until after the Sun published it. There's ways of phrasing things so it doesn't make you look so bad, and I just think that's something they should have phrased a bit better, but they've handled it fairly well, and now we just need answers on dates.
Exactly. I think it's all in the hands of the police now with regards to Ben Stokes. But moving on, because we like scandals, we're moving on from one to another, and another slightly disorganised sporting body at the moment, and that's British bobsleigh. On Thursday, British bobsleigh announced that they can now partially support a women's team following the departure of their chief executive, Richard Parker. The head coach and the performance director had already departed, and this all follows from the 19th of September announcement where the body said that they were withdrawing funding for the women's team but were going to continue to fund the men. Bobsled drivers Mika McNeil and Mika Moore set up a crowdfunding page after that initial decision, and they managed to raise £30,000 in just a handful of days, which will basically get them to the Winter Olympic Games, but that's pretty much it. All this also comes amid the backdrop of an independent review into allegations of bullying, racism and sexism within bobsleigh. One crisis to another for the body, but I suppose there's a little bit of good news in all the bad news at the moment, that they can now partially support that women's team.
Yeah, it's fantastic that McNeil and Moore can now be supported by their own governing body, because that £30,000 that was raised is enough to sort of get them to World Cup selection, and all they need to do is pretty much compete at the World Cup series, and then they're guaranteed a place in South Korea. So that's all good, but that is minimal costs. That is really the basic minimum. So they needed more. They've got up to about 34k on their crowdfunding, and now to get this extra support as well is what they need. And it's not great, but from a bobsleigh point of view, but actually I'm really impressed with how McNeil and Moore went about it. They came out and they were critical, but they weren't critical as such as they're going to ruin their relationship with bobsleigh. And actually they were so pragmatic, setting up this crowdfunding plea, you know, going out there not begging for money, but just saying, look, we deserve to be there. They're the world junior champions back in January. They've got a really, really good shot at a medal this time around. Not a guaranteed shot, but you know, there's no reason why, if with all the funding and everything, they couldn't get a medal.
Yeah, British bobsleigh said that they weren't really medal contenders when they decided to pull the funding.
Yeah, they didn't really think that one through, because they funded the men's team. So if a couple of the men's teams are, you know, in decent shape, they could get a medal. But I think this is British bobsleigh's strongest chance of a first medal in the sport since 1998. So their explanation wasn't great, and that just doesn't help. And it's a governing body in crisis. It's a shame. It really is.
We have no idea when that independent review is going to be concluded. But one thing we were saying before we started recording, with regards to McNeil and Moore, they could have kicked up a fuss. They could have thrown their arms in the air, thrown their toys out of the pram, gone, poor us. But they went about it in such a pragmatic and dignified manner by setting up that crowdfunding page. But they've managed to stay on relatively good terms with British Bobsleigh, considering they had their money pulled.
Yeah, I'm really impressed with what they've done. And they're only 24, so they're fairly young. So they could quite easily have, you know, thrown their toys out of the pram. We saw Kevin Peterson. He's thrown his toys out of the pram enough times, and he's a lot older, and he should know what he's doing. So, these girls have done a great job. And they really touch the hearts of the British fans. I mean, £30,000 doesn't sound like a lot, but I'm sure to actually try crowdfunding that money when no one really knows who you are outside of your sport is it's a fantastic feat. And I was actually on the funding page, and just from random members of the public donating £20 here, £10 here. You know, it's fantastic, and it's great to see them. Even if they hadn't had the partial support, it's great to see them get the opportunity to go and do something they're bloody good at.
Considering it's the 1st of October today as we record it, so what, the Winter Olympics are 4 and a bit months away? To have their funding pulled at that time, when I read it, I was amazed that was even happening. But like you said, it's a body in crisis, and I think they need a major revamp internally and of the hierarchy to really sort themselves out.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to happen before the Games. I think now all they need to do is just put all their time and effort into A, getting through this independent review, and B, just getting their athletes there, you know, getting them to be able to perform at their best, just taking away the distraction, and the coaches and will do that, I hope. They just need to now get them to Pyeongchang, get them competing, and then sort out all this mess afterwards, because 4.5 months, you can't turn a governing body around in that period of time, I don't think.
That's the thing now. I think the focus has to be solely on competition now. Ask the questions afterwards, because such a short space of time, put all your resources as much as you can into getting those athletes and to make them as successful as possible, essentially. But that concludes this first section on this episode of Sportspiel. But stick around, because of course, after our break, it's the feature interview section. And to introduce his guest, it's Mr. Will Moulton.
Indeed. So I finally got my bum in gear and managed to get hold of someone. So I was lucky enough to speak to British shooter Jen McIntosh, who earlier this summer won 2 European golds. She's also Scotland's most decorated female Commonwealth athlete. She's taken records away from her mum, who's also a great shooter, but she's also competing alongside and against her sister, her younger sister Shona. It's a great rivalry. She talks about that at length. She also talks about sort of her progression up the field. So from sort of around 40th in London 2012 to 15th in Rio to, you know, where she could be in Tokyo and all that. And she's a really, really lovely girl. Really interesting chat, so stick around for that. So hello listeners, and welcome back to Sportspiel, where once again we are lucky enough to have medal winning international athlete join us for our feature interview section. This week we are lucky enough to be joined by 2-time European shooting champion Jennifer McIntosh. So welcome to the show, Jen, and thank you for coming on.
Well, thank you for having me.
So for those of you who have missed it, earlier this year Jen won 2 golds at the European Shooting Championships in the 50 metre rifle prone and the 50 metre 3 positions team event. So obviously that's an outstanding achievement, but were they your expectations going into the tournament?
I knew that it was possible. We were shooting pretty well throughout most of the season, and obviously I kind of knew that it was within our capabilities. Particularly the team event, I think, was probably more of a shock than the prone. The conditions were really, really hard as well, which kind of opens up a bit as well. So you don't really expect anything, but you know that you're capable of it.
And you speak there about the different positions, the different conditions, sorry. So is it an indoor event or is it an outdoor event?
No, it's an outdoor event. So it was taking place in Baku in Azerbaijan, and I think Baku might actually mean windy city, because it was absolutely howling a gale. So, yeah, it was really, really difficult conditions for us to shoot in, because normally the ranges are pretty sheltered and you don't get a huge amount of wind, but we had a lot to deal with.
And you mentioned there the wind. So obviously, if there was rain coming down, would you still have competed, or would it have had to be put back?
No, the firing point area is covered.
Okay.
You're protected from the worst of the rain. Unfortunately, with the wind, because it's obviously open so that you can shoot downrange.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the biggest challenges is the wind coming in, and it kind of buffets you about a wee bit.
Okay.
Which is pretty difficult to deal with.
And the three positions, obviously, you're in three different positions where you're shooting the gun. Does the wind have more effect on one position as such, or is it all equal for all of them?
No, it's definitely harder. Basically, the higher up you are, so when you're shooting standing, it's hardest. And then kneeling can be quite challenging as well, particularly if you're, like me, quite tall.
Mm-hmm.
It has a much bigger impact than somebody who's a bit shorter, because you're obviously closer to the ground and a bit more sheltered.
Yeah, that makes sense. But obviously you managed to overcome the conditions and win those two golds. Your sister, Sinead, also won an individual and a team gold as well. How is it, you know, competing alongside her at these major international competitions?
It's fun. It has its challenges, as you would expect. To be competing against siblings is never straightforward, but it's definitely good fun. You know, and it kind of means, you know, if I have a bad day, I can at least something good's come out of it. Her win was obviously fantastic. It's a massive win for her. And it just kind of makes it all sort of a bit easier to take. You know, if somebody's happy.
So you must have some pretty proud parents then when you both go home with two medals each.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my dad is our coach. So, you know, he was out there with us. It makes his life easier in some ways, more difficult in others, I guess. But, you know, as long as one of us is happy. I think it's one of those difficult things where, you know, one of us is always going to be disappointed, even if we came away with gold and silver, one's not going to be happy. But, you know, for him, from his point of view, as long as we're 1 and 2, that's an easy problem for him to have.
And when you're competing against each other in the individual events, do you have to almost forget that she's your sibling and just treat her as another competitor?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, shooting's one of these sports where you're not, particularly through the qualification round, you're really not that aware of who else is on the firing point.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it comes to the finals, I mean, you're so focused on what you're doing that, you know, it's a very individual sport. It's not like you're trying to take the ball off somebody. You know, you're very much in your own little bubble and doing your own little thing. So yeah, but you definitely have to then, you know, think, you know, it's not my sister, it's just another athlete. It can be challenging, but it's definitely a positive.
And then when you're competing together in the team event, does that change, or do you still just see her as a teammate and not a sister?
Yeah, I mean, it's still the team event is concurrent with the qualification round. So again, you're just kind of shooting the same course of fire.
Mm-hmm.
You're just kind of, again, you're just in your own bubble. But you know, again, to some extent, she's your teammate until you kind of get onto the podium. At which point, you know, it's amazing to share that moment with your sister.
Yeah, I can imagine. Obviously, you come from a shooting background. You're born to two professional shooters, both competed at Commonwealth Games. Was it inevitable that you and your sister were going to follow in their footsteps and become shooters?
I don't think it was inevitable. We were both, it was very much our choice.
Mm-hmm.
I probably spent a lot more time on ranges than Shona did growing up, because both mum and dad were shooting a lot more. By the time Shona came around, I think mum did a Commonwealth Games after, in 1998, Shona was born in 1996.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly sort of later than that, mum kind of stepped back and didn't do so much. I certainly spent a lot more time on ranges. And it was, for me, it was just this kind of thing. You know, I was there anyway, I was just kind of bored and, you know, wanted something to do. So, okay, well, let's give it a go. And then it sort of snowballed from there. Shona was actually very adamantly against doing it for a long time, where she wanted... You know, it was my thing, and she didn't want to do it and didn't want to be in competition with me. And then I think the sort of story she certainly tells is she shot a bit at school. She was part of the school team.
Mm-hmm.
But she came to watch me at the Olympics and had one of those, I want to do this moment. never looked back.
And you mentioned there sort of you did a lot more training and trying to maybe didn't do so much, but you've both now won medals. I was just wondering, is it in a sport like shooting, is it down to sort of natural talent, hard work, or like a combination of the two from your perspective?
I would say it's a combination of a lot of different things. Mm-hmm. You know, the amount of hours and experience. I think particularly in a place like Baku where it's really windy, a lot of that comes down to experience. Mm-hmm. In wind. And actually, you know, for all she's not been doing it that long, Shona has got a lot of experience shooting in wind. You know, because we live in the UK and it's windy here. So, you know, experience is a big part of it. There is a bit of natural talent. Mm-hmm. What that talent is, I think, varies from person to person. You know, for some people, it's about how still you can stand, how balanced you are. For some people, particularly, I think, maybe me and Shona more so, it's about performance under pressure. You know, we're both sort of wired that way that actually we get, you know, that sort of adrenaline buzz really helps us. It doesn't tend to bubble over too much. Mm-hmm. But obviously, you know, none of that works without all the hard work and the hours of training that you put in day in, day out. Mm-hmm. Without that, you know, you're nowhere. But, you know, you'd be the most talented athlete in the world. If you don't work hard at it, you're not going anywhere.
And you mentioned the hard work, and you said you've been shooting on ranges for a long time. How old were you when you actually first shot a gun, and how did it go?
I was, I think, 10 when I first shot a rifle, just off a rest, so it wasn't too hard. Yeah. I was probably about 12 by the time I started doing it properly. Mm-hmm. 14 probably when I started competing. And it was, I was actually really not very talented. Like, I was really not the kid, you know, there was a whole load of other juniors that shot with me at the same sort of time. And I was not the one that you would have picked out as being the most talented of that bunch. But I was probably more stubborn than the rest of them. And I'm the only one that's still doing it. So yeah. I guess stubborn this one out.
And was there a particular moment then when you were going through the junior age groups where you actually thought, you know, you could turn this into a career?
Yeah, I think it was the sort of the moment where everything changed. I went to the Commonwealth Youth Games in 2008. Mm-hmm. I was the same. I just started my last year in school. And so went away to the Commonwealth Youth Games, came home with a silver medal, had loved the experience, you know, loved being part of that team environment. You know, just it was all amazing. Came home and then, you know, school were immediately like, okay, we're doing UCAS applications today. And I just kind of sat there and looked at it and went, I don't want to do this. Mm. I don't want to do that. I want to shoot. So, you know, I went away and I went home and I talked to my mum and my dad and I started my UCAS application and I was thinking about doing things like art or English, and just kind of didn't see how that, you know, didn't see a future for myself in that, and spoke to my parents and spoke to some of the teachers at the school, you know, asking them what they thought, what if I went and trained full time, and eventually decided that I was going to leave school and train full time. And originally the plan was just for a year, and my parents supported me through that so that I could give myself the best chance for going to the Commonwealth Games in 2010. Mm-hmm. And then I did really well at it, and suddenly there was a bit more cash available for me, both from Sport Scotland and then later from UK Sport, and yeah, just kind of never looked back since then, really.
And you mentioned there the 2010 Commonwealth Games. You won two golds and a bronze. Could it have gone any better, really?
Yes.
Oh, really?
Yes, it really could have, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah, no, I definitely, I remember very definitely. We had the three positions, the individual and then the pairs match. Mm-hmm. And I actually shot terribly in the pairs match.
Oh, really?
If I'd shot even, I didn't even need to come anywhere close to my PV and we could have won that.
Oh, wow.
At the time I remember feeling very disappointed with that bronze medal and feeling like I'd let my teammate down because she'd shot a PB.
Yeah.
And then in the individual match, again, I didn't shoot that well, managed to scrape into the final in fourth and then, you know, messed up the final and finished fifth. And again, was bitterly disappointed with that. Mm-hmm. At the time, you know, a few days later, then won two gold medals back to back in the prone. so you were kind of took the edge off that. But definitely, like, every athlete's like that, though. You know, you're never satisfied. You never win 100% of the time. There's always times where you look at it and think, oh, I could have done that better, I could have done that better. I think even when you win, sometimes you look at things and think, oh, that could have been better, I could have done that better, I would have done this differently.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just kind of part of, I guess, elite sport.
Yeah, I guess so. But I mean, from the outside, though, it still looks pretty impressive. And also, I think there was a record of Scotland's most successful female at a single Commonwealth that you then held that you took from your mum, I believe. So when you found out, how did that make you feel?
Well, I obviously knew that mum had won gold and silver, and that had made her the most sort of successful female athlete at Games. I think that somebody had subsequently held that record between us.
Mm-hmm.
But it was quite sort of satisfying, you know. I mean, partly because, you know, in the lead up to it, it was all this comparison to being like your mum and,
mm-hmm.
you know, following your mum's footsteps and stuff. And it was that kind of moment that I felt like I'd sort of stepped out and made a name for myself on my own. And it was, you know, I'd done it by myself. I was no longer Shirley McIntosh's daughter. I was Jennifer McIntosh in my own right. And that was quite a sort of special moment. I was quite smug about it. In fairness, mum's pretty chilled out about it. I was just kind of like, well, yeah, if anybody's going to break my record, I'm glad it's you guys. it was a really special moment.
And then, going forward from that, we'll skip forward to 2 years. Another special moment for the country, London 2012. From your point of view, though, how was that tournament?
I mean, it was an incredible experience. I don't think there's anything can compare to a home Olympics. I was lucky, I think, to be part of that team. I very definitely benefited from a host nation start,
mm-hmm.
And I think it was probably, I set myself really unrealistic goals and had unrealistic expectations of myself. You know, you kind of paint this fairy tale picture where you go to the Olympics at your home games, and I was, you know, one of my events was the first medal event of the games, and, you know, I had painted myself this fairy tale where I was going to win the first medal of the game for GB.
Mm-hmm.
And funnily enough, that didn't happen. But, you know, it was an incredible experience. I came down with actually like an inner ear infection a few weeks before, which completely messed with my balance, which made the whole thing very difficult to take, because it kind of, you know, it was one of these things. Did I shoot badly because I wasn't ready, or did I shoot badly because I was ill, or, you know, what was the problem? So, you know, from a personal point of view, I was disappointed with how I shot, but there was reasons for that. But the actual experience of the games was incredible, not like anything else I've ever experienced in my life.
And you talk about the experience there. We hear from a lot of athletes who take part in athletics and things about how amazing the crowd was. In shooting, obviously, the crowd has to be a little bit different, but was that something you also felt?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. Yeah, shooting, like, normally, I mean, we go to, like, World Cups and stuff, and the, you know, spectators are one man and his dog. You know, it's not exactly a sport that generates a lot of crowds. So, you know, I knew in advance that the crowds were going to be big in London, because, you know, we were struggling to get tickets for family and stuff. So I knew there was going to be a lot of people there, and, you know, there was going to be a big crowd, and a lot of the attention was going to be on me for no other reason than the fact that I was British, not because I was competitive and expected to win anything, but just, you know, the home games and everybody's interested in the home athlete. So we'd actually prepped a lot for that. I'd done a lot of distraction training, creating noise in the range when I was training. So, you know, music. Dad would set cameras up, like, right in my face, so that, you know, I was getting used to TV cameras and all that sort of stuff. But even with all that preparation, I was still completely caught off guard. You know, we started the match, and normally it's just quiet. And if there's any sort of noise and applause, it's, you know, if somebody shoots like a world record at the end of the match, there's sometimes a round of applause. I remember actually very clearly the first shot, I think I took like 3 or 4 attempts at it. You know, I picked up the gun and I looked down the sight and went, no, I'm not happy with that, put it down. Picked it up, no, I'm not happy with that, put it down. And that happened 3 or 4 times until eventually I managed to get the shot off, and it was a 10. And there was a big round of applause went up from the spectators behind me. And I kind of laughed at it and then fired the next shot. And again, they sort of applauded. And I, you know, I, by this point, I was kind of off into my own wee bubble and didn't really really realise what was going on until mm-hmm. about three or four shots later, where they'd clapped every time I'd shot a 10. And they did the whole match, 40 shots. Every time I shot a 10, there was this massive round of applause.
Oh, wow.
And it was weird. Like, I've never had anything. Like, it was incredible. But it was not like anything I'd ever experienced. And I've never seen since, actually, on a range. And there was a lot of very sort of high-level athletes, you know, multiple Olympic medalists came up to me afterwards and were just like, you dealt with that really well. I've never seen that before. And it was just, you know, it was crazy. But incredible, you know, that's memories for life, that is.
I can imagine. And then 2 years later, of course, the Commonwealth Games in Glasgow in Scotland, was it a similar sort of situation there with the crowd applauding you pretty much every time you took a shot?
No, it wasn't quite so bad. Good, whatever way you want to look at it. It wasn't quite so obvious. I think probably because there was more British athletes there. You know, there was a wider spread of athletes and a wider spread of people, you know, where people were from watching. It wasn't just Scottish spectators there watching Scottish athletes. There was mm-hmm. English, Welsh, Irish, etc. But there was still, you know, really good home support, and that was really special. I think having, you know, competed at, particularly where the range was, they built a sort of temporary facility on Barry Budden Army Base.
Mm-hmm.
I used to go up there a lot with the school and shoot sort of cadet stuff up there. So it was quite, although it was disappointing to be out in a satellite village and be in a temporary venue, it was still sort of quite special for me to be back there competing for Scotland
mm-hmm.
on a range I used to shoot on as a kid. You know, it was really quite sort of special.
And you won two more medals, and I think you become Scotland's most decorated Commonwealth female. If that's,
yep.
And I mean, that must have been a proud moment for you to have done that at your home games as well.
Yeah, definitely. I think by that point, I've kind of started, you know, sort of titles, but most decorated or most successful. It sounds a bit blasé, but you're just kind of like, okay, well, next step.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah, no, it was very special. I think one of my medals was presented by my mum, actually.
Oh, wow.
Which was, that was a really incredible moment. I would be lying to say I wasn't disappointed, you know, with the results.
Mm-hmm.
You know, two medals is amazing, but you always want a gold, and definitely, like, knew I could have done better. And like I said, you know, as with Delhi, you're always looking at it going like, well, I could have done that differently, and I could have done that differently. That could have gone better. But you know, it's just such an incredible thing to do that at home with all the sort of pressure that brings as well. You know, there's no denying you expect more of yourself, you know, aside from what everyone else expects of you, you expect more of yourself.
Yeah. And I was going to ask you a similar question about Rio as well. Obviously, you finished a lot higher than you did in London, and from the outside, they seem like pretty good results. But are you still sort of going through that similar process of could have done that better, could have done that better, and things like that?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's definitely, like, you know, there's, well, one particular shot. My last shot was a really, really bad shot in the three position, and that sort of, I'm not going to say it haunts me, but it sticks with me quite a lot.
Yeah.
You know, so you always have moments of, like, oh, that could have been better. But, no, I was definitely a lot happier with those results.
Yeah.
Again, sort of really feel like I've got more to offer, and I know in my heart of hearts that I'm capable of more than that. But it's all sort of like an upward progression, and, you know, maybe it's just going to take me a bit more time than I'd hoped to get there.
And you talk about the upward progression. There was a big investment, actually, in shooting, a big monetary investment in shooting after Rio. So how has that had an impact on you at all so far?
I don't think it's had a huge amount of impact on me at the top level. You know, we've always been fairly well looked after.
Mm-hmm.
I think the really big difference will be further down. You know, the academy athletes, I think, are probably better being looked after a bit better now and further down into sort of grassroots and talent development and coach development and talent ID and all that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I think that'll really help. And, you know, that longer term, that helps me, because the more people we have pushing through and the more competitive the sport is,
mm-hmm.
the better I get. You know, I certainly noticed a big jump in my scores when Shona started shooting, because suddenly there was somebody pushing me and I couldn't just sit back and be complacent. You know, I think that's all really good, and, you know, hopefully help grow the sport. And I hope, you know, I really hope that our successes help grow the sport. you know, people sort of see the news and think, oh, that sounds like fun, let's go and try that.
Yeah.
I hope it'll all help sort of, you know, grow the sport overall more than anything.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, coming up in 2018, you've got the Commonwealth Games and the Worlds next year. Realistically, what are you hoping from those two events?
Yeah, I mean, for Commonwealth Games, obviously, having won 5 medals, I'm targeting more medals. I'd be lying if I said anything else. You know, in terms of colours and numbers, you can't really control a huge amount of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not just about how you shoot on the day. You can't control how other people shoot on the day. So, just want to go out and give my best, and yeah, of course, want to come home with some medals.
Mm-hmm.
For World Championships, I guess it's kind of, again, you know, it's a very difficult sport to predict.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things change a lot on day to day. Some things you don't always have a huge amount of control over. I would really hope to be making a final at the World Championships. But, you know, so long as I'm coming sort of top 15 placing, I'm going to be pretty happy with that. I think sometimes the standard at World Championships is even higher than the Olympics.
So mm-hmm.
it can be pretty tough.
And one final question for people listening to this who are now thinking, I might want to give shooting a go. Sort of, what advice or what messages would you pass on to them?
I would definitely recommend it. It's a really, really great sport to get involved in. It's very inclusive, you know, boys against girls, old against young, very sort of disability friendly as well. You know, so I would really recommend giving it a go. You know, just find out your local club. You can contact British Shooting or the National Small Bore Rifle Association to find out where your local club is, and just go down and give it a go. It's, you know, very sort of welcoming communities, and you know, hopefully get everybody set up and get you going as fast as possible. So yeah, definitely recommend it.
Fantastic, and that's all we've got time for this week, but thank you very much to Jen, and yeah, we'll be back soon.
Well, it's a big thanks to Jen McIntosh again for taking part in that interview. And it's now time for some housekeeping / parish notes. Our writing section is going to be expanding quite a lot over the next while as we're putting a team together. That will all be fully announced on social media on Tuesday, as we've got a nice collection of talented writers. So hopefully we'll be bringing you a lot more insightful, opinionated feature articles on our website. Also, you can follow us on social media, like us on social media, that's Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, all of them are at SportsspielPod. And of course, you can send us feedback to our email address, which is sportsspielpod@gmail.com. That is all from us on this episode of SportsSpiel, unless you have anything that you want to add.
No, I'm just very excited to see what the other writers can produce. It's great to have some fellow team news associate guests writing for us as well. So it's going to be a good future.
Yes, I should say a big thank you to all of them in public. I will say it to all of you individually as well for agreeing to come on board. But from us this week, we'll see you in 2 weeks' time. Have fun, everyone.